Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
You're listening to Today, I'm Sui. Chinese authorities are suggesting that trade talks with the United States have made important progress. A statement following the latest round of talks in Washington describes the discussion as candid, specific, and fruitful. The talks have touched upon topics including intellectual property rights protection, technology transfer, and balanced trade. China agreed to expand imports of U.S. products, while the U.S. side suggested it would take China's concerns seriously. The two sides also reached a consensus on a framework aiming to implement agreed-upon results. A timetable for the next round of negotiations have also been worked out. Join our panel to talk about the trade talks between China and the United States and the broader China-U.S. ties are Dr. Zhao Hai, a research fellow with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Einar Tangen, author and columnist, as well as George Tsoukalos, a senior research fellow of the International Center for European Studies. If you want to listen to this episode again or catch up on previous topics, please download our podcast, World News Analysis. So now let's begin with our discussion first about the trade talks in Washington this week. Dr. Zhao Hai, what's your major takeaway from the negotiation this time?
Well, I think the negotiation went as planned. Just before this trip of Vice Premier Liu He to the United States, we've heard rumors about U.S. declining two vice ministers' visits. And it turns out, and people in the market are worried about the upcoming conversation. However, it turns out that this trip was quite successful. And you can see it from the statements put out by both government and from actually President Trump's his own Twitter. So far, even though there's no final draft of the agreement, but they are working very hard toward that end. And after this very detailed and diligent discussion, I think they have agreed upon many things in principle. And the following jobs will be focused on more details and technical stuff. And the American team will come to China soon. And hopefully, before the end of February, we can have a better, we can have a deal forming gradually.
So, Einar, what's your general observation this week?
Well, it seems that Donald Trump wants to do this. I mean, he has two China hawks in there, Lighthizer and Navarro, who have never been friendly, and they concentrate much more on the structural issues, how China governs itself, state-owned enterprises, these types of things. And basically, Donald Trump has hijacked these talks. I mean, he comes out with this glowing statement about Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, quote, one of the most respected men in the world, unquote. Interesting. And he's made it very clear that he wants to meet with Xi Jinping. This is very much the big mogul style that he likes to use, that he will come in and save the day and that these other people around him are just functionaries who do his bidding. So I think this is heading up to be something very positive in terms of settling this dispute, at least for now. Structurally, I think there are still issues out there, but there seems to be enough on the table so that Donald Trump can claim victory and China can get on with its economy.
So, Dr. Tsoukalos, what's your observation, particularly about their statements issued after the negotiation?
Thank you for having me. I believe it was a positive round of talks, and it seems that the two sides are trying hard to find a solution before the March deadline. And also, President Trump gave an interview to the New York Times, suggesting that it is possible for a deal to be reached. However, the American president remains very unpredictable. So we have to wait and see until the U.S. delegation travels to Beijing in mid-February for relevant talks with the Chinese delegation. It seems that it is possible for an agreement to be reached, but again, the role of both Presidents Xi and Trump will be catalytic, and this is also what President Trump says, that before a final deal, he will talk or meet with President Xi to discuss about all the details. I believe that as things are developing, the personal relationship between the two presidents can play a role.
In particular, this time, the two sides talk about a framework designed to implement the agreement. From the perspective of some U.S. media outlets, they call it a verification or enforcement mechanism. So, Dr. Zoukopoulos, what kind of framework are they talking about here?
Well, the American priorities are clear. They are very much interested in the protection of intellectual property. They are interested in seeing more American companies to invest in China. And they are also interested in seeing the American exports vis-a-vis China to increase. So what they are asking for is a serious commitment from the side of China within this context. On the other hand, however, China is also an economic colossus, so it doesn't necessarily have to accept all the American terms. And that's why the framework needs to be flexible. And also, China is a country which has shown in the last month that it is able to cope with the trade war despite some of the pain, which is equal in both sides, because we do not have to see necessarily China as the only country suffering by the trade war. Also, the United States is suffering, and some of the companies of the United States are also complaining to the American president for the continuous trade war. So the framework needs to be accepted from both sides in order for it to be sustainable in the next month.
Einar, what's your take on this framework designed to implement the agreement?
Well, it's going to be very difficult to do. Remember, this is not government to government. This is actually, it's going to be private companies to private companies. And currently, the only way you can really settle these things is to bring them into the court, either if it's a Chinese company in the U.S. court or a U.S. company into the Chinese court. If they're going to propose something else, it's cumbersome. You're either going to have to name an existing body that can do it, some sort of arbitration group, or you have to come up with your own. And Donald Trump is not the trusting sort. He doesn't like any kind of independent body. He's made that very clear with the WTO. And so it's going to be hard to see how you put that together. One of the big issues here, though, is despite all the progress, you know, he turned down the offer by the Chinese to have another intermediate meeting a couple of weeks ago. And people were surprised because so much of all of these things that we're talking about depend on just pages and reams of paper of detail, schedules, when things are going to happen, what happens if they don't happen, you know, all of the things that we're talking about. And Donald Trump apparently was not interested in that. So I think he's really looking at the big play here. I think he wants a big round number, which he can hold up and say, look, I've solved the U.S. trade deficit. I've brought jobs back to America. Even if it's not true, it'll look like he's created more opportunities for U.S. businesses and agriculture. So he can also use that as part of his narrative to get his wall thing. So I see this as mainly political on his side. I don't know that you can settle all of the issues that have been building up for these many years simply in a few days or in a few conversations.
Dr. Zhao, your suggestions about this framework, is introducing a third party a good idea?
First of all, I think when Trump said in his Twitter that there will be a grand deal, that nothing will be left off the table, and everything, the trade dispute between the two sides will be solved through this deal, I don't think that will happen because, as Anna pointed out, there are so many issues, so complicated issues. It's very hard to resolve it in such a very short period of time. President Trump emphasized that March 1st will be the real hard deadline, that he doesn't want to go over it. Therefore, if there's a no deal, then he would like to continue to impose the higher tariff. So I think that will be putting pressure on both sides to try to reach some kind of deal that will be agreeable by two sides. So the key about the framework is actually similar to the dispute settlement mechanism that is built in probably both, for instance, in WTO and then in USMCA, the recent trade deal. And there will be some kind of committee composed of people from both sides, from US and China, and then they can go over some of the issues to make the decision whether or not enough progress has been made. However, this must be, as China has already pointed out, a two-way reciprocal process, meaning that not only U.S. Should or could participate in the mechanism in monitoring progress on the Chinese side, but China also will send people to monitor what's going on in the U.S. because China also has problems concerning U.S. export practices. So I think overall, this mechanism will give both sides, because now there is not enough trust between the United States and China. Therefore, they need a mechanism, a procedure to go through so that to make sure that both sides will stick to their promises made through that deal.
Mm-hmm. So like Dr. Tsakopoulos suggested, we see their state leaders of both sides, President Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump, played an important role in these trade talks. So Dr. Zhao, how do you see this factor, the diplomacy carried out by the state leaders?
Well, as I said before, that this the real final decision maker and real chief negotiator are the two presidents in U.S. and China. And the negotiators like Vice Premier Liu He and also Lighthizer from USTR, they're working on the technical details and they're trying to resolve detailed problems. Overall, ultimately, this is going to be a strategic and a political decision. That's why it's very important for President Trump. Actually, he understands this, and he understands that even if there's no such a political decision and political will to push forward the negotiations, it might bog down by one or two just issues, and they will continue to negotiate without end. That happened before. So I think at this point, you know, diplomacy, what do you call diplomacy, or the, you know, the pressure from the outside, from the market, from both societies, from other countries, ultimately the pressure will be on both leaders, and they will have a very strong political will to reach the end and have a deal to give back to their domestic audience. And for President Trump, as you can see from his Twitter, that he really want to have this victory, because in February, another thing that is the another summit between the United States and North Korea will happen, and he would very much like a double win in that single month, and that will actually give him a political credibility back to the U.S., therefore to kind of backing him up in terms of future negotiations and confrontations with the Democrats. I think at this moment, that's what it's at stake here.
Mm-hmm. Einar, how do you see this factor, the communication between the two presidents, has been playing out in the trade talks?
I'm going to have to disagree with my learned colleague. I Trump is extremely unpredictable, and that's why we're all collectively holding our breath to understand how he's going to react to conservative media. Because remember, he was all set to sign the bill. And when he got some flack from Ann Coulter and from Rush Limbaugh, he flipped and he, you know, imposed the shutdown. So the question is, will that happen here? And in terms of Xi, I don't see him engaging in this kind of big, you know, verbose policy, Twitter type things. Very deliberate. Everything is plotted out. Basically, they have all these institutes who are looking at every possible scenario out there and creating a playbook that he's going to use. So this is not flying by the seat of your pants type of stuff. Xi is very deliberate. He's very calculated. Donald Trump is very transactional. He's willing to flip on a dime. He'll look for any opportunity or any kind of weakness and press on that. So I think you have really two very different people here. Donald Trump says that he's a great friend of Xi's and that they have great chemistry. That may be, but it has not been reflected in his actions in terms of how he's treated not only China, but the rising storm of anti-Chinese media stories, which seem to emanate from a lot of people who support him.
Thanks. Let's take a short break here. We're talking about the trade talks between China and the U.S. and also their broad bilateral relationship. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
With the great efforts made by the staff, Today become one of the great platforms for policy debates and information dissemination. And I wish Today have an even brighter and greater tomorrow.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. We continue our discussion about the trade talks between China and the U.S. I think one aspect not so many media outlets mentioned when they talk about these is trade talks between the U.S. and other major trade partners like the EU and Japan. So, Einar, how do you see the trade frictions between China and the United States if we examine the issue from this broader picture?
Well, broadly speaking, I mean, everybody is flummoxed by Trump. I mean, no one knows exactly what he's going to do. You know, talk to his neighbors, Mexico and Canada. They were belittled. They were treated badly. But in the end, they ended up with a slightly better deal than they would have had been imposed if the United States had actually joined the TPP, which was supposed to, in essence, supplant the existing agreement, NAFTA. In terms of Europe, they're thinking, are we next? If some detente is declared between China and the U.S., is he coming after us? He's already threatened car tariffs. And with Brexit on one end and, Italy on the other end, I mean, the EU is very, very concerned about internal unity, and yet they are facing off an unknown. And that's really what we're talking about here. You go anywhere in Asia or anywhere else, no one knows exactly what Trump is aiming for, what he's going to say, if he's going to withdraw from an agreement, if he'll even keep an agreement. And this is really what is the stem root of this, what's pushing the economy down. People don't know what to do. Consumers are concerned, and you're seeing a lot of pullback. A lot of economists, and I would agree with them, are forecasting a recession that will be starting about 12 to 16 months in the future as, the effects of people not having a lot of confidence starts to dig in. And that means consumer confidence in the sense people aren't buying as much, they're saving more, they're a little more concerned, and also business confidence. Where do I put my factory? Is there going to be decoupling? Maybe I should be putting it in a third country. Maybe, depends on where I'm going. But right now, people are sitting on their hands, and that's going to have an effect.
Dr. Zakopoulos, what do you think about this? Like Einar just said, like Europe is asking, are we maybe the next?
Well, the European Union is also, to some extent, having is in the same position as China as far as negotiations on trade are concerned. And it is currently not clear up to what extent the European Union and the United States can cooperate in order to better deal with China, or on the other hand, if the European Union and China can cooperate from their side in order to deal with the American president. There are two dilemmas for which there are no answers, and I was recently in Brussels, and I could not find out up to what extent, on the one hand, the European Union can trust the American president in order to work with him and better deal with China, or the European Union can count on China in order to deal with the new threat that the American president is bringing to world economics. As far as the relationship between the United States and the European Union is concerned, and from a European perspective, the current mood in Brussels and in various European countries is very, very negative, and the whole approach from the side of Europe is that the American president does not trust the European Union as a strategic partner, and this includes both trade issues as well as other commitments related to defense and collective security. As far as Japan is concerned, this is another country, as you correctly suggested, which is now suffering by the U.S.-China trade war. And we, if we look into the new approaches from a China, or from a Japanese perspective, as far as the exports of the country are concerned, they have started to be damaged because of the continuous trade war. So we can see that even if countries which do not necessarily agree on several issues between them, they can build a common front in order to respond to the continuous trade war which is being started by the American president.
Dr. Zhao, how do we look at the trade talks between China and the U.S. if we look at the broader picture, the trade talks among the three economies?
I think the people, the countries that should be more concerned should not be European countries. Actually, because China will increase dramatically the purchase of agriculture, energy, and other manufactured goods from the United States, the direct competition competitor with the U.S. Are countries like Brazil, Australia, and Canada, and Russia, the Central Asia countries, because those are the country exporting agricultural products to China and also energy products to China. Maybe in the manufacturer sector, European countries will have more conflict competition with the United States. That being said, I think on the one hand, it's clear that Trump is very volatile and it's hard to predict. However, Trump's message was very consistent from the very beginning, from his campaign. And until today, he's pushing his agenda, America first, all along. And because of that, his conflict with the European Union is unavoidable. He has been asking for reduce, just like with China, with the EU, less reduce U.S. Trade deficit. He's trying to impose tariff on U.S. auto export to the United States, which is aimed at supporting U.S. domestic auto industry. And also, if you look at the agenda that has been put on the table, the U.S. is trying to negotiate with the EU, the number one issue is actually digital economy. And the U.S. in that area, because the U.S. and both U.S. and China now have very strong and giant companies in that area, however, in comparison, the EU has a very limited number of big internet companies, less capital. In that area, the U.S. wanted to be the rule maker of the next generation digital economy. I think that conflict will be, in that area, the conflict will be more severe. The thing is, if U.S. and China settles differences, the U.S. turns their gaze towards Japan or European countries. It's very hard to imagine because the more intense conflict between the United States and EU because ideologically they share the same ideology and also their mutual investment is much higher than the mutual investment between U.S. and China and U.S. Japan. So I think in many areas, the restriction, the parameter of their negotiation would be tighter than U.S.-China. There will be a lot of forces at play and to basically limit the choices and options of President Trump in his negotiation with other developed countries.
So looking forward, like we mentioned, the American negotiation team is planned to travel to China later this month, and the two sides are talking about the possibility of another meeting between the two presidents. So, Dr. Zhao Hai, a little bit preview or speculation, where do you expect the talks are going in the next few months?
With the U.S.-China talk?
I
think, well, on the one hand, we will have to focus on more details and just like you said, the framework or the mechanism, how they will check the progress and have a timetable later on for the latter half of this year and then the next year. Because Trump is facing another election by 2020, he will probably play this card continuously, the trade issue, to rally up his base and also to have continuous support from the conservatives. So I think in many ways, if this issue is not getting closer to what he demands, there will be still problems. That's why the negotiations will be very hard. And also, as Einar has pointed out, you know, the hotliners like Lighthizer and Navarro, they will be paying a lot of attention not only to intellectual property issues, but also like subsidies and non-tariff barriers. And those are the areas where the issue has been there for many, many years, and it's very complicated, very hard to solve, not only between U.S. and China, but also in WTO, these kind of issues still don't have very clear rules. And also, because of the difference between developed and developing countries, there used to be some sort of difference. However, now U.S. has made the proposal to the WTO, trying to eradicate the definition of developing country, making this issue more complicated. So I think moving forward, they will have to tackle this issue and try to come up with more creative solutions so that they can reach a final deal.
Thank you very much. That's wrap up the first half hour discussion. I'll take a short break. In the second half, we'll focus on the broader bilateral relationship between China and the United States. Our panel is Zhao Hai, a research fellow with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Einar Tongan, author and columnist, and George Tsoukalos, a senior research fellow of the International Center for European Studies. You're listening to Today. We're discussing the trade talks carried out in Washington, D.C. this week between China and the United States. And in the second half, we will discuss the broader bilateral ties between the two countries. Stay with us.
I am Alka Acharya. I teach at the Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Today has organized its programs and it rests on bringing in a lot of views from all over. It is an extremely good platform for information and analysis, and I wish it all success in the future.
This is Today. I'm Sui. Chinese authorities are suggesting that the trade talks with the U.S. have made important progress. A statement following the latest round of talks in Washington describes the discussions as candid, specific, and fruitful. The talks have touched upon topics including intellectual property rights protection, technology transfer, and balanced trade. China agreed to expand imports of U.S. products, while the U.S. side suggested it would take China's concerns seriously. The two sides also reached a consensus on a framework aiming to implement the agreed-upon results. A timetable for the next round of negotiations has also been worked out. In this episode, we're discussing the trade talks between the two countries and also their broader relationship. Our panel is Zhao Hai, a research fellow with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Einar Tongan, author and columnist, George Tsoukalos, a senior research fellow of the International Center for European Studies. If you want to listen to this episode again or catch up on other topics, please download our podcast, World News Analysis. So let's move on to the bilateral relationship between these two countries. Dr. Zhao, we know China and the United States in the past 40 years actually witnessed several of this kind of a twists and turns, ups and downs. So what can we learn from those history, the downturns, and also recovery from those downturns?
Well, a lot can be learned from this, and I think the first lesson is that in the previous cases, China and the U.S. shared strategic goals first and then shared economic interest. So ultimately, we have to confirm the more shared interest, particularly in global governance, to confirm that in the future, this bilateral relationship will be maintained as stable, cooperative, and constructive as possible. Right now, as you can see, that there are other issues at work, and sometimes it could be very destructive and erosive in terms of bilateral relationship. That happened before, for instance, after 1989 and after some conflict, for instance, the bombing of Belgrade, of Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999. So every time when there was a crisis, the bilateral relationship will free fall. And after that, you can see that the foundation of the bilateral relationship will regain its strength gradually and rebuild itself. So I think we're now facing the same difficulties when the mutual trust has been lowered and there are difficult issues to overcome. But ultimately, I personally believe that there are so many shared interests, particularly globally and strategically, that both countries must come back to a better relationship, to learn to trust each other, to coexist, and to help maintain a peaceful and prosperous global system.
Einar, like Dr. Zhao mentioned, China and the United States witnessed several downturns or even crises in the past 40 years. What do you think the two countries can learn from those history?
Well, I think we have to be pretty frank about what actually happened in 2001 with the WTO, and that was many people in the West, in the U.S. in particular, thought that this would be the death knell of the current regime, the communist government in China. They really believed that, this kind of idea that capitalism and democracy, liberal democratic capitalism, is the ultimate solution, that every country must embrace it or will embrace it inevitably. And it's a very ideological stance. So what you have today is China, instead of failing, was extremely successful. And this goes against the grain for those diehards, the American exceptionalist group. And, you know, this includes Lighthizer and Navarro and Miller and Bannon and all the rest of them. They really feel that somehow they've been tricked, that China changed things. But now that you flash forward, I'm going to agree with Dr. Zhao. If you have any kind of a sophisticated understanding of what's going on in the world, it's very difficult to separate these things. Everything is moving towards this more digital economy. If you're going to fight terrorism, you have to be linked up. You can't create blind spots for yourself. If you're going to have stop global contagions, either physical through disease or financial, you have to cooperate. And this is what is really perplexing. You have Donald Trump, who does not like any entity that is multilateral. He despises them all. He thinks they're all weak, and unless he controls them, they're no good. So that is really the one big impediment we have here. One is the sense on the U.S. side that, and sometimes shared by the Europeans, that something's wrong, out of kilter. China is not doing what it should be doing. And the other part is this Donald Trump's insistence on these kind of unilateral attacks through trade tariffs, and his insistence that he doesn't want himself or the U.S. to be part of any kind of multilateral group. How can you have global governance if you can't talk to each other, if you don't have mechanisms to sit down and solve things? It cannot be a law of the jungle the way Trump is imagining the world, with the U.S. at the center of a wheel and each spoke going out the tire being a bilateral relationship where the U.S. can use its superior economic, political, and military might. And this is one of the things that's most troubling about this, is that his willingness to do this. Every time there is a negotiation, for instance, a mid-level negotiation, he was sailing Navy ships within the 12-mile zone of the disputed island, the Shisha Islands. Before that, he was sending ships up and down the Taiwan Straits. His willingness to rattle the saber, to put in his white papers that he wants to use India to block China, these are kind of very long-term hostile indications, and this is why it's very unsettling. His worldview does not include getting along. It's really law of the jungle.
Dr. Tsakopoulos, how do you make of this? If we compare the situation today with the situation the two countries experienced in the past 40 years?
Well, there's a complete different situation, and this is mainly based to the peaceful development of China. Look at how China was 40 years ago and how the country looks today. It is an economic colossus, and it is a country which is becoming a new superpower, although we should talk about a multipolar world order. So if we compare the situation in the Cold War period with the situation after the Cold War period, again, there is a big difference, because following the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the U.S. was the only superpower in the planet for approximately 10 to 12 years until the 11 September terrorist attacks. And then it became clear that the United States could not go alone in order to save the world order, and more countries, including China, started to develop. So as the situation is developing today, it is clear that from an American perspective, there is a concern that rising China could possibly cause some problems to the United States as far as the Republican point of view is concerned, but also the Democrats share on the whole this perspective. What is happening right now is that we are looking for a modus vivendi in order for the two countries to peacefully coexist, because even if the United States remains the superpower in the world, the peaceful development of China is the most important development, and this cannot be reversed, and the two sides need to work together.
Right. So more about that. We heard Dr. Henry Kissinger recently suggested it's a little bit difficult for the two countries to go back to the relationship was like several years ago or decades ago. So Einar, what's your take on Dr. Kissinger's argument? Like, how much did the fundamentals of this pair of relationship change, I mean, over the past few years, probably 10 years?
Oh, it's fundamental, John, and I would agree with Henry on this particular issue. There has to be—you cannot go back in time. Back in time, you know, it doesn't even make sense. You can never go back home, as they say. It's not just the U.S. and China, though. Europe is in there. You have South America, Africa, Russia. The days and ASEAN, the days of this, two-power relationship, I think, are over. I think it really has to be something where it's consensus-based. Now, the UN is not been particularly effective. WTO is under siege. So a lot of the institutions out there are not serving as well. I mean, basically, WTO has been salt and put Doha around. There's no consensus on how to go forward, especially on very thorny social issues. So at this point, I think China should be inviting the EU, Russia, the U.S., and key countries who can represent the interests, not exactly the G20, but something along that lines, to talk about how to put something together where there can be a multilateral interest. But it's not going to be with this president. Donald Trump would absolutely be against that. The question is, when he's gone, will there be a president who is more amenable to this idea that the world needs to be managed, not dominated?
Right. Dr. Zhao, what do you think about the argument by Dr. Kissinger?
Well, I would have to agree with him too, but I think also I agree with Einar. Basically, it's not just U.S.-China relations change, but fundamentally the global multilateral relationship also changed because of the fundamentals, and particularly economic forces have pushed this world to a very different, now we have a very different picture. I remember 10 years ago, a political scientist, I think Fareed Zakaria, wrote a book called The Rise of the Rest. And he basically argued that because of 2008 financial crisis and the U.S. economy has been damaged badly, and other countries, particularly China and other emerging markets, are rising, and not only economically, but ultimately they will have more political power, and the world is marching towards a more kind of multipolar world. That is gradually coming into reality, and from G7 to G20 is a recognition of this reality. When you have more more different economic powers have developed gradually and have more power, more saying, more voice in the global system. In terms of U.S.-China relationship, I forgot to say one thing is that if you look back in history, whenever the U.S. disregard of China's core interests, that is China's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and its right to development, there will be problems. And whenever the U.S. recognize China's core interests and respect that, and there will be a relatively peaceful period of bilateral relationship development. So I think in the future, same thing will apply to this rule, which is if the United States recognize China as a peer and respect China's core interest, then in many other areas, the U.S. and China can work together in terms of non-proliferation, unconventional threat to the world, climate change. There are so many issues that both sides can work together and lead. But if the U.S. take another direction, and particularly those hawkish people in the Trump administration advocating decoupling the economy, threatening China, using Taiwan as a card, and also have this freedom of navigation thing going through South China Sea more and more frequently, challenging China in every perspective. I think there will be a continuous tension between the two sides, and ultimately, as other people worried about, that there might be a new Cold War or some kind of direct confrontation that might lead to crisis. So I think over time, of course, this period of time, both countries need to adapt to the new situation. And during this process, we'll see a lot of zigzagging, a lot of unstable, unpredictable period of conflicts. However, after this period, I think both countries will feel more comfortable dealing with each other, and there will be more rules setting in place so that they will follow these rules and to avoid conflict and then enhance the aspect of cooperation. So overall, I remain optimistic about the future of bilateral relationship. It's just right now we have to overcome a lot of difficulties.
Dr. Tsakopoulos, what's your take on this? If we examine the fundamentals of this pair of bilateral relationship and also the fundamentals of the world order?
Well, I'm also optimistic that the bilateral relationship will evolve harmoniously in the future. Although there are differences, it is very good that the two sides are having contact so regularly and frequently. They are sitting on the same table and they are discussing in order to find a solution. As far as how the future will see the two countries, I'm not able to assess how the relationship will evolve. Not only because the American president is a little bit unpredictable, as all my colleagues pointed out before, but also because it's not clear to me right now what the Democrats also are looking for in cooperating with Trump vis-a-vis China. Because following the result of the midterm elections last November, it seems that the Democrats could agree with Trump as far as a more aggressive American policy towards China is concerned. But at the same time, a victory of Trump, a theoretical victory of Trump in that regard, could be a defeat for the Democrats, who are trying to present themselves as the ones who are defending the workers in the United States. So I don't think that there is currently consensus in the United States in order to deal with China. And in that regard, from the moment China is employing a more systematic approach, it seems to me that the peaceful development of China cannot be reversed. And in that regard, it will be the United States which will be encountered with more difficulties in better dealing with China in the future. But as I said, it's very good that the two sides are discussing about differences. They are understanding that the danger of a real crisis will be very important for both countries as well as for the world, and they are prepared to find a solution, and always a solution requires compromises from both sides.
Thanks. Let's take a short break here. In the last segment, we will continue our discussion about the general relationship between China and the United States. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Michael Zhang. Greetings from Los Angeles of the Golden State of California. Thank you today for making me part of your team. I truly enjoyed the debates we had and look forward to many more in the years to come.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. So let's continue our discussion. I think these days, many of our listeners are getting familiar with this term called decoupling, like we also mentioned in our previous discussion. We heard a lot of debate on whether the two countries are actually really in the process of decoupling. So Dr. Zhao, what's your observation? Are these two economies really like being decoupled?
I think in the United States, there are people who are advocating decoupling and actually putting some of the policies into place so that they can force American business, academic institutions and others that are used to getting involved with China, Chinese market, Chinese cooperation to decouple. However, I think because of in the past 30, 40 years, U.S. and China have gradually built a great bond, and they're economically interdependent, and they have close relationship. There are so many, every year, hundreds of thousands of Chinese students go to the United States to study, and there are close to 100 different mechanisms between the two governments are still working. So I think it's very hard to decouple, and it's going to take a very, very long time, and the consequences and damage that would be done by this kind of decoupling is very unpredictable and could be very huge. So I think in the short run, these people would like to use like tariff and like legal means, for instance, that they're trying to punish Huawei. And also they're using other administrative power to try to cut ties between U.S. and China. And in the short run, maybe they will get some results. But I think it's going to recover. And because both countries need each other and the world needs the two countries to continue to communicate. And plus, even during the Cold War, Soviet Union and the United States maintained a lot of channels to communicate with each other and a lot of cooperative relationship, even in the space. And U.S. and China share much more common interest in global governance. Just recently, China held the five nuclear countries meeting in China trying to develop non-proliferation mechanisms. So I think it's very difficult to decouple, but we have to guard against this trend and we'll have to fight back against this intention of trying to decouple U.S. and China relationship.
I know, like Dr. Zhao Hai mentioned, there are certain groups of people in the United States who are promoting this decoupling. So what's your observation? Like who in the U.S. particularly wants to see a decoupling between China and the U.S.?
Well, unfortunately, two of the people who are sitting at the at the bargaining table, Lighthizer and Navarro, they both believe that the United States would be served by this idea that you pull everything in and you just take care of, you know, the U.S., which is the largest market, and everything would be fine. The fact is that that's not true. I was chairman of my state's International Trade Council at that time. Many years ago, we estimated about 40% of the state's economy was related directly or indirectly to exports. And we already seen that now. You see GE is suffering. Also, Harley-Davidson, which is also from Wisconsin, is now putting up a factory in Thailand. Why? To service the EU and China, because they don't want to take the political risk that's being out there. But let me put this in the context. We've talked a lot about, but where is all of this coming from? You know, if you go back to 2001, the world GDP was $33.4 trillion U.S. dollars. Go to 2017, it's $80.7 trillion, so more than 2.5 times. But interestingly enough, Europe and America only grew at 70 and 80%. However, when you start apportioning profits, two-thirds of all the profits that were garnered during that time went to the developed nations, primarily the U.S. and Europe. Yet, their middle classes stagnated during that period. Now, the rest of the world, who only had one-third of the profits, their middle classes actually grew astoundingly. So what we're really talking about here is a failure internally in these developed countries, where they failed to distribute the income, to grow their middle class, to keep things solid, and now they're pointing the finger at almost everybody else and saying that it's their fault that this happened, not our failure to manage, our greed, just simply it's somebody else's fault.
Right. So, Dr. Skoblos, what's your suggestion that's even possible to decouple the two economies?
Well, I think it is not possible. What we are observing under the Trump presidency, but also before, is that the United States is very concerned about the development of China. It is attempting to create more opportunities for its economy as well as for American companies to invest in China. And this American approach now does not only stay in the United States, but we are observing that also the European Union is sharing some of the concerns of the United States as far as the Chinese economy is concerned. But at the same time, even if we look at what is happening in the United States, it is clear right now that several American companies which want to invest more in China, indeed, they are not happy with the policy of the American president, the policy of the trade war of the American president. We are also seeing that even in the Congress, many American congressmen are not satisfied with the extent to which the American president is using the national threat plane in order to further develop the trade war against China. So this said, it is clear that even in the United States, even under current circumstances, there are several serious voices which are warning about negative consequences in the future should the two sides do not find a common a modus vivendi in order to peacefully coexist in the world. What is also happening in the United States is that there is also a concern about the implementation and the rollout of the Belt and Road Initiative, and that's why American companies feel that they could lose several contracts all over the world, and they want to create kind of a fear in order for several countries around the globe to stop giving contracts to Chinese companies in order for more Western companies to become involved. I think that these are the problems. This is the main skepticism right now in the United States and also in the European Union, but I believe that it is in the interest of both to find a common solution. That's why I don't believe that any decoupling can be sustainable in the future.
Thanks. One last question. Einar, do you feel that the two sides may have some misconception or misunderstanding between each other, both when we talk about the political circle, business world, and also academia, maybe?
I would say yes to that. I mean, the number of times that people from the Trump's administration and Trump have hinted that anybody who's Asian is somehow a spy or things like that, the attacks on Huawei, ZTE, these types of things. There were problems with these companies, but they were out of magnitude when you start comparing them to similar companies that were based in the U.S. and Europe and other places, which did far more egregious things in terms of the amount of sanctions they busted, whether it was money laundering or working with countries that they were not supposed to. They were actually supplying vital information. In these particular cases, we're talking about very minor things. So, and there's also a different mindset. I mean, one of the main things that I always try to explain to people is that in Asia, there's a very different conception of the individual and society. Generally, the society is paramount, and the group is paramount, and the individual is secondary to that. But in the West, it is reversed. And this is one of the reasons that you hear this kind of constant refrain that they don't understand each other. There's all sorts of human rights abuses. What is considered a human rights abuse in Asia is if you're not taking care of people, they don't have a safe environment, they don't have a job, they don't have enough to eat. That is human abuse, and that is the fault of the government. In the West, we tend to see it as, oh, you can speak your mind, you can go out and you can create change, you have the right to hold a sign saying that you're very unhappy. So there are a lot of cultural elements to this, but some of it is political, and that's what I was alluding to before. The decoupling will occur if people continue to have this they don't understand the problem, and they continue to look for people or other entities that are problems.
Thank you very much, Einar. That was Einar Tangen, and also other panelists, Zhao Hai, George Zagopoulos. The program engineer of this episode is Yaqing. We're talking about the trade talks between China and the U.S. and their general bilateral relationship. I'm Sui. Have a nice weekend.